From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the December 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. We shall fight to the last shell. 80 years ago this month, Britain was marking its fifth Christmas of the war with still no end in sight. D-Day still lay in the future, and the campaigns in Italy and on the Eastern Front ground on. However, on Boxing Day 1943, the Royal Navy achieved a significant, if grim, success over the German Navy, sinking the Scharnhorst, one of the few last remaining large warships in the enemy fleet. This victory would help to secure the safety of Allied convoys to Russia for the remaining 18 months of the war. The Codebreakers of Bletchley Park played a key role in helping the Navy to locate Scharnhorst and were spectators on the final battle via the German messages read in Naval Section at BP. For this It Happened Here episode, we're joined by Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, who's recently published a book on this subject entitled Arctic Convoys, Bletchley Park and the War for the Seas. As usual, our thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson and Sarah Langston for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, tell us about this ship, the Scharnhorst.
The Scharnhorst is sometimes described as a battleship, sometimes described as a battlecruiser. It's a pretty large warship. When it's built, it's one of the largest warships in the German Navy. One of the issues with the Second World War German Navy is, of course, that at the end of the First World War, the German Navy is effectively abolished by the Treaty of Versailles. The Germans are only allowed to keep a small number of very out-of-date ships, and they're allowed very few sailors. So during the 1920s and 30s, they are very restricted in what they can do in terms of their naval capability. In the late 1920s, they build a series of ships which get termed pocket battleships by the British. And this is a slightly weird type of warship because the German Navy is constrained by the Versailles Treaty on how big a ship it's able to build. And so they have a 10,000-ton limit. And other countries like Britain and the USA have a similar 10,000-ton limit, and they build what are called heavy cruisers. But the Germans try and pack as much punch into the tonnage limit as they can, so they build these ships known as pocket battleships, which have much bigger guns than their, or what will be their allied opponents. The most famous of these is the Graf Spee, of course, that was sunk in 1939, right at the beginning of the war. Later in 1935, once Hitler has come to power in Germany, the rules on the German Navy are relaxed. He manages to negotiate the 1935 Anglo-German Naval Agreement with the UK. And at that point, a lot of the brakes are let off in the sense that the Germans are allowed to build much bigger ships, but only on the premise that they only ever have a third of as many ships as the Royal Navy has. The Royal Navy is allowed to keep a 3-to-1 advantage over the German Navy. And under that agreement, the Germans commissioned two much bigger ships, 30,000-ton ships. These are the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, who are pretty much identical sister ships. And they enter service in January 1939, just before the beginning of the war. To give you a sense of what Scharnhorst looks like, it's always described by naval historians as a very good-looking ship, which sounds like a strange phrase for a warship, but it has these very elegantly raked bows. I mean, it was very fast. It did over 30 knots, but it looks kind of sporty. It has 9 11-inch guns, so it's also pretty powerful. To put this in context, it's 235 metres long, so it's two football pitches long, so it's a pretty big ship. You know, it's up there with the biggest ships of the era. It's only put in the shade, really, a couple of years later when Bismarck and Tirpitz are commissioned, and they are even bigger ships again. But I think Bismarck is something like 36 or 40,000 tonnes, so it's not twice the size. It's a little bit bigger again, but Scharnhorst is still up there. Both of these ships, they see action in various places, both in the Atlantic and in the Channel, but also in Norway. Their first real appearance in the war is after the German invasion of Norway. They move into the North Sea and sink the British aircraft carrier Glorious. And this is a story we've covered before when we've talked about Harry Hinsley, because at that time he was following the German ships by his traffic analysis work on German naval communications. And the Admiralty didn't really believe him. And it was only after Glorious had been sunk by Scharnhorst and Gneisenau that the Navy kind of woke up to what Bletchley Park was doing in some senses. But we've talked about that on a previous occasion in the podcast. After that, the two ships set out into the Atlantic and have an operation where they try and sink Allied convoys. They have a number of encounters with both convoys and warships, but they don't actually end up sinking a huge number of merchant vessels. And then they come back from that to the French ports, Brest in particular. While they're in harbour in Brest, the RAF is successfully able to bomb them. And so both ships stay there for about a year, being repaired and then bombed and then repaired. Mm-hmm. And the next time they sort of feature in the historical scene, if you like, is the Channel Dash, as it's called, of January 1942, where the Germans had decided that the two ships needed to be got from France, where they were getting bombed, back to Germany, where they would be safer. And they had a choice. They could go all the way around the UK the way they'd arrived, or the other option was to sprint for it up the channel. And there's an incident in January 1942, Operation Cerberus, where they do exactly that. And again, we've talked previously about how the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force response to that wasn't as effective as it could have been. The Germans managed to sort of, by a series of failures and coincidences, managed to make it most of the way back to Germany unscathed. In fact, both ships ran into a minefield. The RAF just about managed to drop some mines sort of in their path, and they sailed over these mines and both ships were damaged.
These ships tended to be used as a pair as well, though.
Yes, they tend to go around as a pair, certainly up until 1943. It's in 1943 that they part company with one another because Gneisenau is much more heavily damaged in the Channel Dash than Scharnhorst is. So Scharnhorst is ready to be used again before Gneisenau has been fully repaired. And Gneisenau is never actually fully repaired. It kind of stays in dock, sort of repaired, right up to the end of the war. However, in March 1943, Scharnhorst is ordered up to Norway. And this is partly to get involved with the operations in the Arctic, but it also is a good jumping off point that if they want to do another operation in the Atlantic, if they want to sail around past Iceland and go and interfere with the Atlantic convoys, that's an option for them as well. So getting the ship up to northern Norway is a good strategic move for the Germans. So that's the first time Scharnhorst is seen kind of in the Arctic area.
Making use of captured enemy film, we recall the Channel Dash of the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau from Brest, when with the Prinz Eugen and every available aircraft, the convoy raiders raced for their bases in Norway. Here through enemy eyes is how the Swordfish of the Fleet Air Arm under the command of Lieutenant Commander Esmond VC went against them. One of the finest exhibitions of self-sacrifice and devotion to duty that the war has witnessed. Considerable attention had been paid by our Navy and Air Commands to keep these two warships pinned down. They represented powerful supplements to German naval strength in the Battle of the Atlantic. With propaganda pictures, the German Admiralty were telling their end of the struggle with such pictures as these.
Why was Scharnhorst so important in the Arctic?
Well, the Arctic convoys differ from those crossing the Atlantic in a number of ways. And one of the things I explore in the book is the idea of the differences between the Arctic campaign and the Atlantic campaign, and in many ways, the similarities between the Arctic campaign and the Mediterranean. And the key one of those is the fact that the campaign takes place close to land. And what this means is that there's a very small gap between the North Cape of Norway, the very farthest tip of Norway, and Bear Island, which is about 270 miles, something like that, north. And then beyond Bear Island, for most of the time, you then get Arctic ice. So there's this quite narrow space. And this contrasts completely with the Atlantic, where you've kind of got all the sea room you want. The ships can sail around to avoid convoys and things can maneuver. But it also means that the convoys are nearly always in reach of the German Air Force. Land-based bombers can fly out from bases in northern Norway and attack the convoys directly, which doesn't happen in the Atlantic. But the other thing that happens, and this is why Scharnhorst is relevant, is those same fjords where the German Air Force is based provide ideal hiding places for German surface ships of their navy. They've got U-boat bases up in the Arctic, but they've also got places where they can hide even the biggest battleships because these fjords, you know, they've got steep cliff sides, they're very long and deep and twisty, and they're perfect places to sort of position a ship like the Scharnhorst. And it can sit there in relative safety, especially up near the North Cape. They are out of range of bombers from the UK. The RAF just doesn't have aircraft that can fly that far. But at the same time, they're within only a couple of hundred miles of where the convoy's got to sail past. So while you don't get much German surface ship activity in the Atlantic, so after Bismarck sunk, that's basically it, really. In the Arctic, there's always a strong incentive for the Germans to keep their surface fleet in that part of the world. And as I said before, it gives them this alternative that if they do want to go into the Atlantic, they can sort of nip round the top of Scotland and Iceland. And that gives the campaign a completely different sort of character, because both sides are always thinking about their surface warships as well as the more familiar U-boats and merchant ships, which is normally the story of how sort of convoy battles happen. And so long as there is a German warship or warships in the north of Norway, the Royal Navy is forced to keep a lot of the home fleet, which is based in Scapa Flow in Orkney. Those ships, which might otherwise be doing other things, have to stay there to protect the convoys. And every time a convoy sails from either Scotland or Iceland to go to Russia, the ships of the home fleet have to, they sort of go some of the way towards Russia and hover about waiting to see whether the German surface ships come out of the fjords. The difficulty with this is that the home fleet can't go all the way to Russia with the convoys. They do it once or twice, but it's a very risky undertaking because those German bombers are available in the north of Norway. If you sail massive British battleships 100 miles from the coast up there, they will get bombed, particularly after the experience of the Prince of Wales and the Repulse off Malaya in 1942, when the Japanese destroy those ships in very short order using dive bombers and torpedo bombers. The Royal Navy is uncomfortably aware of the air threat to their ships. So they have this sort of juggling act of having ships available, but having them far enough away to be safe, but also waiting to see if the big German ships kind of poke their noses out of the fjords or not. And of course, we'll speak about this in a minute, but that's where Bletchley Park comes in, because keeping an eye on what those German ships are doing is absolutely crucial to the strategic situation. Ironically, by the time you get to 1945, it becomes clear that the German surface warships have had very little influence, material influence, on the campaign. They've sunk about 3 merchant ships amongst all of them by the end of the war.
That is surprisingly few.
Yeah. But at the same time, their influence, in spite of that, on the campaign has been absolutely huge, because they've tied up all these Royal Naval vessels. And in the situation of, for example, PQ-17, that convoy is scattered because they think it's going to be attacked by Tirpitz. Actually, all the losses from that convoy are ships sunk by aircraft or by U-boats. But the reason they're vulnerable to the aircraft and the U-boats is because they've been scattered to avoid Tirpitz. So the influence of any German surface ships in North Norway is huge. It just is sort of a force in being, sitting there in the fjord lurking.
Just the threat of having
just the threat of them is really, really significant. By the time Scharnhorst sails up to the Arctic in 1943, the situation has changed, because at the end of 1942, a year before the battle we're talking about today, you've had the Battle of the Barents Sea, it's called, where the Lützow and a force of German ships sailed in exactly the way we've been describing. They left Altenfjord and they went out to attack a convoy, but they were beaten off by a force of British destroyers, which they ought to have been able to defeat. There are all sorts of reasons why that battle turned out the way it did, but the main one is the German commanders, under such pressure to protect their ships and not have them damaged or sunk, that they end up being really, really timid and ineffective. And despite the fact that Hitler has imposed that restriction on them, he then gets typically Hitlerian and crazy about it all. And there's a point where he says, let's just abolish the surface navy altogether. Let's just have U-boats in the navy, and all of the rest of them can be, take the guns off and put them in coastal defences and scrap them and use the steel for something else, which is, you know, a pretty radical step. Admiral Raeder, who had been in charge of the navy up to that point, resigns at that point. He goes, I'm not going to do that. And Dönitz, who has just been in command of the U-boat force, takes over as commander-in-chief of the Kriegsmarine of the navy. But he's basically told, you can keep a few ships in Norway, but most of the ships are either going to be scrapped or they're going to be sent to the Baltic, where they shell the coastline, assisting with the Russian front. So when Tirpitz goes north, you only have Scharnhorst and Tirpitz in Norway. So there's only 2 ships there, plus a few destroyers. There's about 5 destroyers, which are much smaller ships. You need to escort these big ships when they actually sally out to sea. There is one operation that the 2 ships do together, which is in September, Operation Zitronella. Tirpitz and Scharnhorst sail to the island of Spitsbergen, or Svalbard, as some people know it, where there is a very small Allied outpost with some Norwegian troops and some British troops. And Tirpitz and Scharnhorst sail up there and they bombard the outpost and put a landing party ashore and capture some prisoners. It's a propaganda exercise. It has no bearing on the outcome of the war. Ironically, it's the only time the battleship Tirpitz ever fired its guns in anger at the enemy. Despite all, you know, Tirpitz being around for most of the war, it only ever shoots at anybody once, and that's when it does it. To no great effect, really. And then they sail back to Norway again. Shortly after that, Operation Source takes place. And Operation Source is a miniature submarine attack on Tirpitz and Scharnhorst in the fjords. As I said, the British have this problem that, particularly in the north of Norway, it's very hard to bomb enemy ships, so they have to come up with other plans. And one of the plans they come up with is for these famous X-craft, these miniature submarines. The operation isn't a complete success, but they do manage to blow up mines close enough to Tirpitz that they damage it quite badly. And they basically put it out of commission until the spring of 1944. Ultra is also important in that because the British are able to find out from German communications about the repair of Tirpitz, how long it's going to be out of commission for. And so knowing it's not available to use is a really important piece of intelligence because you don't have to plan against it.
Well, reducing that threat we were talking about as well.
So basically all you've got left is Scharnhorst and a few destroyers. That's all the German surface fleet is left. They've still got U-boats up there. They're able to put, you know, half a dozen U-boats to sea at any one time. So the U-boat campaign is carrying on, but in terms of the surface operations, they've just got this one ship and its escorts.
Deutsche U-Boote kehren von siegreicher Feindfahrt zurück. Wieder haben sie viele 10.000 Tonnen feindlichen Schiffsraumes vernichtet. Konteradmiral Dönitz zeichnet besonders verdiente Besatzungsmitglieder mit dem Eisernen Kreuz aus.
You've mentioned Ultra a few times already. Can you tell us a bit more about what role Bletchley Park played in the convoy battles?
Bletchley Park provides a huge amount of information on German activity in the area where the Arctic convoys are operating. My focus has been on looking at German naval Enigma, which is a huge source of information. You've also got the Luftwaffe, so there are German Air Force codes being broken as well. But the main focus is on naval Enigma. And that, again, as we've covered in previous broadcasts, German naval Enigma was broken by Alan Turing in Hut 8 in the late summer of 1941. And the convoys in the Arctic actually start in August 1941. So the convoy operations in the Arctic start more or less at the same time as Bletchley Park starts reading German naval traffic. So the two coincide quite nicely from the Allied point of view. In 1941, the German Navy are using two principal Enigma keys. There's the Heimische Gewässer, home waters as it's called, which Bletchley Park codenamed Dolphin, and then there's foreign waters. The foreign waters key is never really attacked by Bletchley Park because it's mostly used by ships much further away, so ships in the South Atlantic or Pacific or whatever would use foreign waters. There are German blockade runners, merchant ships sort of bringing products back from far away to Germany, but there's not a lot of naval action going on, so Bletchley Park isn't particularly interested in that work. But the home waters network, they break it in May 1941 for the first time, a little bit intermittently through the summer, and then pretty much permanently from the autumn of 1941 onwards. And that continues for the rest of the war. And the operations in the Arctic, both the U-boat operations and the surface ship operations, are run on the Dolphin network, or using the Dolphin key, for basically the rest of the war. There's a slight change in 1945, late 44, 45, when they start introducing additional keys, which is, you see across the spectrum of Enigma that at the very end of the war, there's a sudden explosion of the number of keys in use. But Naval Section and Hut 8 found at that point that they were sending so many times, because they had, if they went from one key to four, they would then send the same message on all four keys because they needed to send it to the, you know, the same group of people.
That's helpful.
And so actually they got what they call re-encodements, which meant that you could read all four keys. Once you'd broken one of them, you could break the other four. So it didn't really help the Germans very much. So essentially Bletchley Park is reading this, just this one key, which tells them what the Germans are up to. That work is actually done in Hut 8, the breaking, but similar to Army Air Force Enigma with Hut 6 and then Hut 3, you have Hut 8 doing the breaks and then providing the raw decrypts to Naval Section. And Naval Section is doing all the intelligence analysis, working out what these messages actually mean, where the ships are, and then producing tidied up versions that are teleprinted to the Admiralty as, well, Z traffic, they call it. I mean, in modern parlance, we refer to it as Ultra. It's sort of Bletchley Park Enigma product, but they refer to it as Z traffic.
This is that actionable intelligence.
Yes,
that we sometimes talk about.
The useful stuff. I mean, again, there is a fiction that the Admiralty is getting everything.
Yeah, word for word, verbatim.
Yes, but they're not.
Right.
Frank Birch estimated they were getting about 40% because, you know, a lot of what they intercept is very garbled or it's trivial or whatever. So they're getting the juicy bits, but they're getting about 40% of the traffic. But that's still a huge amount of information. Usefully, Naval Section gave these messages serial numbers, and they used a series of different codes for different networks and different sources when they're sending the information to the Admiralty. The particular code we're interested in is ZTPG, which is Z for Z traffic, meaning Enigma, TP meaning teleprinted, and G standing for German. And ZTPG is basically the home waters network, the home waters key. You can tell how many messages were sent because ZTPG1 is sent on the 15th of May 1941, which is when they first start breaking Naval Enigma. The last ZTPG message is intercepted on the 5th of May 1945. They don't break it very quickly because the war has ended, so it's only sent to the Admiralty on the 23rd of May, by which time we're after VE Day. That was ZTPG 369,189.
Usefully enumerated for historians such
yes,
as you.
Very much so. But it shows that in, what's that, a little over 4 years, they've sent 370,000 decrypts to the Admiralty. So it's a huge quantity of information, and it provides an enormous intelligence advantage. What's very cool for me as a historian, and brings you very close to the story in this case, is all of these ZTPG messages have, at the bottom, the initials of the people involved at Bletchley Park. Because there was a team called The Watch. They would see the raw decrypts and the intelligence, and they would draft the clean version that they were going to send to the Admiralty. And so their initials are on there. And then there was literally a hatch in the wall, and they would pass it through to a WAF teleprinter operator, and she would then actually type it onto the teleprinter, and it would go to the Admiralty. And her initials are on there as well.
Wow.
And this all took place just a couple of doors down the corridor from where we're sitting now in Block A. So it's just around the corner here.
Wonderful. Those people often forgotten as well, the sort of intermediate stages in the process.
Very much so. Some of the guys who were doing this, there's two in particular, there's the Ettinghausen brothers, Ernest and Walter Ettinghausen. Walter goes on to be very famous as the first foreign minister of the government of Israel after 1948.
Known as Walter Eitan by then.
Walter Eitan by then, yes. But WE and EE appear as initials on these teleprints. And we can go a stage further because in our oral history archive here at Bletchley, amongst all the recordings and testimony we've got from veterans, we have testimony from a veteran called Sheila Holding, who at Christmas 1943 was actually in the teleprinter room just down the corridor here doing exactly this job. And she described in her account how she remembered her initials being on the messages. And I was able to go to the National Archive and rummage through, and sure enough, her initials are right there on the teleprint messages.
Fantastic.
It paints a picture that's quite interesting to me because, as we said in the introduction, you're in the fifth winter of the war. It's you know, this must have been feeling never ending at that point. You know, it's dark. She's on night shift. You can see the timing of the messages she's sending. She's on night shift. It's Christmas. She's on duty Christmas Eve. The 23rd, I think, she's on duty on Christmas Eve, overnight. And you can imagine them sitting down there mm-hmm. in the cold, in the dark. Oh, it's Christmas, but yeah, here we are. She's not actually on duty when the battle against Scharnhorst happens. The initials change. It's somebody different on shift at that point. And then she's back on shift a couple of days later. Whether she kind of looked back and went, you know, I missed the action. But she is one of the few people at Bletchley Park, certainly in her grade, among the sort of women employees who are mostly doing this quite menial work. She's front and centre because she's typing these messages in plain language to the Admiralty. She's typing out events in the war more or less as they're happening. So she would have been one of the people really seeing what was unfolding. She gives a rather lovely account of what happened to her, in fact.
At Station X, our teleprinters were all on direct lines to the Admiralty. And what made it so interesting was the fact that the messages we were sending, having first been intercepted, then decoded into plain German, were then translated into English for onward transmission in plain language. Whereas I learned later that others were sending just groups of figures. Very boring. All the messages I typed up always started to ID8G, which was the Admiralty, and then from NS Naval Section Bletchley Park, which was our call sign. The text would be in plain language, and thus we were always very well informed on naval matters. The messages were typed directly onto the teleprinter, and I know it came out at the Admiralty instantaneously as I was typing it.
You were saying how the ZTPG traffic ran from 1941 all the way through to 1945. But isn't there something about the shark settings not being readable anymore, how the Germans changed all their naval keys halfway through the war and crisis ensued at Bletchley Park?
Yes, there is. In the spring of 1942, the Germans roll out four-rotor Enigma, the M4 Enigma machine, to their U-boats in particular, but also a lot of their surface ships. And in the Atlantic, the U-boats go over to using effectively all four rotors of the machine, and that gets the new code name Shark. And Bletchley Park doesn't read that at all, basically, until November 1942. There's a pinching operation on U-559 in October 42, which we've talked about again in a previous episode. So the U-boats in the Atlantic, their messages become unreadable for most of 1942. Fortunately for those operating in the Arctic, or for the Allies in the Arctic, the U-boats there carry on using Dolphin. They carry on using the home waters key throughout.
Right.
Four-rotor Enigma is only fully rolled out to the German Navy very, very late in the war. And these U-boats have four-rotor Enigma machines on them. They've got M4 machines, same as the ones at Atlantic. But what they're doing is they're setting the fourth rotor to its neutral position and operating the machine as if it were only a three-rotor machine. This is because they are, as we've been saying, they're operating with other sorts of ships, surface ships and all sorts of things involved. Mm. It's much easier for the Atlantic U-boats to use four-rotor Enigma fully because it's only U-boats in that campaign, really. There's nobody else they need to talk to.
Right, yes.
But on the home waters network, where the U-boats are operating with, it's not only the German surface fleet that's attacking the British, but you've got German coastal convoys because the Germans are moving a lot of iron ore and minerals up and down the Norwegian coast, and they're doing all sorts of other naval activity, which we're not talking about today. So essentially, they stay on ZTPG throughout the campaign. If you go to the National Archives, there's actually a separate series called ZTPGU, which is U-boat specific, which is effectively the shark traffic from the Atlantic.
Four-rotor stuff.
Yeah, and then later on you get ZTPGM, which is when the Germans introduce a separate network for the Mediterranean. So there's a separate archival series for each of the different keys that the German Navy is using. But we only need to worry about ZTPG. I say we only need to worry about it. It's still 370,000 messages. And one of the features I found working on this was that for each convoy, you're still probably reading 5,000 messages. If that convoy's at sea for 10 days, each block of 1,000 messages in the archives typically covers 2 to 3 days. So if you want to read what the Germans were sending for the whole period of a convoy cycle, you know, to Russia and back, you could be reading 5,000-6,000 Enigma messages at a go.
Have you read all these 370,000?
I haven't read
messages?
All 370,000. I feel like I've read tens of thousands. I say read. What you do is they're downloadable from the National Archives website, so I could do this in my study at home. But you get an image of the message, the teleprint on the screen, and I got very good at just scanning them. And you can see from sometimes the addressees, or if the word, you know, Calais appears, or Saint-Nazaire appears, or, you know, the Channel Islands appear, you can flick past very quickly. But if Alton Fjord appears or Admiral Northern Waters appears, you stop and you read that message in more detail.
This sounds very similar to potentially what was happening in naval section or at the Admiralty as well.
You become very aware of the triage system within naval section because these messages are filed in the ZTPG series in order of dispatch to the Admiralty. They're not necessarily intercepted in the same order. So some of them are decrypted quite quickly and others are decrypted more slowly, depending on the priorities in the section. So what tends to happen is if there's a convoy operation going on, you get a whole clump of Arctic messages together because they've been moved up the pile, the priority pile, and all done sort of one after another quite quickly after they've found the key for that day. And so you read all those, then you start to get North Sea and Channel messages. And usually by the time you get to Baltic messages, you know you're getting to the bottom of the pile because naval section wasn't particularly bothered by what was going on in the Baltic. It's more of kind of academic interest and just updating their ship catalogues and things like that. So you'll get this sort of progression. And then you get lots of boring messages about the Baltic. And then a key change occurs and suddenly you're getting the most urgent traffic at the front again, you know. Right. So it's not like they're just completely mixed up together. There is a sort of pattern to it. But it's only by reading them in job lots of 1,000 at a time that you start to pick up the pattern and you can kind of get a feel. What was quite, I'm going to say exciting, it wasn't exciting, it was tremendously tedious. But what you do get if you sit down and you read that much ultra traffic just in bulk you get a real flavour for how the system worked. And like you said, how it must have felt at the time of people going through this stuff. And you also get quite a lot of sort of interesting side stories, because one of the things that the German Navy does, particularly with U-boats, is they send a lot of traffic which is not operationally important, but is sent for morale purposes, so that, you know, if a crew member of a U-boat has a baby, they'll send a message saying to Stoker Schmidt, you know, mother and baby doing well, born yesterday, sort of thing. So you get these little moments of humanity in there as well. And then on other occasions, you'll see like some freighter in Norway has run aground on a rock. Mm-hmm. And then a few messages later, you see the rescue ship going to get them off the rock. And then you get messages from rescue ships saying, oh, we haven't found it, or it's already sunk, or whatever. So these little sort of vignettes play out in the message traffic.
So what kind of intelligence overall were you seeing in particularly the ZTPG, this dolphin traffic?
Well, from the point of view of protecting the convoys, there are three sort of key areas, if you like. The first, fairly obviously, is the U-boats. And U-boats only work or only operate in groups. It's relatively rare that you get a single submarine sailing around on its own, because they're not actually very capable by themselves. What you have to do is you send them out in groups. And English language books use this term wolf pack, that I think was christened by Churchill. The Germans never call them wolf packs. They just call them groups. And they're not even a group in the sense that they don't operate like a pack. What they tend to operate like is in a string. And what you do is you put in what they call a patrol line, where if you think a convoy is sailing from east to west, you'll distribute, you know, six or eight submarines in a north-south line, all kind of 20 miles apart, across the route that you think the convoy is going to sail.
So one will intercept
it. So you've kind of thrown a net out. And the idea is that the moment one of them detects the convoy, all the others then home in. And quite often, if you have one that detects, they won't attack straight away. They'll stay hidden and they'll shadow it and wait until all the other submarines have been able to gather together. Mm-hmm. And then at the appointed moment, they'll all attack at once, because obviously that's much harder to defend against. But to the benefit of the Admiralty and to the disadvantage of the Germans, in order to do that, you need to have a whole lot of radio communication, not so much between the submarines, but from the land-based commander, who is telling them where to put the patrol line. And then one of them will signal back to the base to say, I've seen a convoy. But that message won't necessarily have been picked up by the other submarines.
So
the commander on land then has to send the order out and say, yeah, you know, U-231 has seen a convoy at this location in this grid square. Please now move to this grid square to attack it. So there's a huge amount of back and forth with the submarines. And Bletchley is able to read that pretty thoroughly. There is a time delay, because with each key change, it takes them a number of hours to do the bomb runs they need and everything else and find the relevant key setting. And so this information is coming in a bit late. But certainly from the point of view of U-boats, they move slowly enough that if they're told to form a patrol line up near Bear Island, it could take them a day to get there anyway. So the decryption cycle is fast enough that it still provides you with that information.
And I suppose they're getting an idea at least of the trajectory of those U-boats as well.
And just simple things like how many boats are out there, you know. One of the difficulties versus the Atlantic is, as I said earlier, the gap between Norway and the Arctic ice sheet, especially in winter, is so narrow that there's not a lot of sea room to sail around the end of a German patrol line. So sometimes they just have to plough on straight through it. But they know it's there, you know, so they're getting that advantage. And certainly later in the war, when they have more escort ships available, they do a thing where they'll send escorts that don't stay with the convoy. They'll actually sail 100 miles ahead of the convoy and reach that U-boat patrol line first and attack it before the convoy ever gets there. So that information is really useful. The second one is the German Air Force. The German Air Force attacks convoys. Bletchley Park interception isn't particularly useful against attacks, because it tends to be that they are ordered in a relatively short time before they're launched. It's only a matter of hours between the Germans saying, you know, send this particular squadron to attack this particular convoy. So the information about attacks isn't terribly helpful. You tend to read the message going, send 40 torpedo bombers, when you know the attack's already happened. But what is useful is the German Air Force have long-range patrol aircraft. They have these Focke-Wulf Condors that were originally designed in the 1930s as long-range airliners. The first non-stop flight from Berlin to New York was undertaken by a Condor. And what this means is they have huge range and they can stay in the air for a very long time. So they're great maritime patrol aircraft. You can send one of these things out over the Arctic Ocean. It can spend most of a day just flying around looking for stuff. And in that situation, what those aircraft report back can be really, really important. Because to come back to the Scharnhorst, for example, or the Tirpitz, the Germans know that the home fleet is trying to attack them. And so when a convoy sails, the first thing the Germans need to do is find the convoy. And the way they'll do that is they'll send these reconnaissance aircraft out. and the British can listen to the aircraft, and they know when the aircraft finds the convoy and sends a message, says, I've found the convoy, then you know at that point that the strategic situation has changed because the Germans know where the convoy is. The second thing in terms of surface ships is if they want to send Tirpitz out to attack that convoy, they won't do that unless they know where the British battleships, King George V, are, and the aircraft carriers and everything else, that what they call the covering force. So if the German Air Force is saying, oh, we can't find the covering force, we can't find the Royal Navy, then you know that their battleships aren't going to set out from the field, because they wouldn't do that unless they knew where we were, where the Allies were. So it's a slightly complex, indirect story, but it's exactly how intelligence works, is you can infer one thing from something else.
To Murmansk, past Hitler's bomber bases in Norway, over this route, the Nazi Luftwaffe held pitiless and unbreakable sway. From their bases all along the coast, German long-range bombers lay in wait to spot the convoys and keep them under surveillance until short-range dive bombers could strike. At all costs, the Nazis were determined to stop the flow of Lend-Lease aid to Russia. Men of the Navy and the Merchant Marine knew that assignment to the Murmansk run was almost a sentence of eventual death. But for every ship destroyed, for every crew lost, a dozen others got through with their cargoes intact. To Londonderry, to Murmansk, under a hail of bombs and through the wolf packs, the Atlantic convoys got through.
The third area that the intelligence gives information on, of course, is the surface ships. And here again, part of that is the strategic picture, knowing how many ships are involved, which ones are in Norway versus which ones are in the Baltic or in repair or wherever else. And by this point, they're comfortable that they know how many there are. There's Scharnhorst, there's Tirpitz, there's five destroyers. That's all well known. They also know who the commanders are and broadly, you know, what the Germans' ambitions are. The other thing they do is, on a good day, they can tell if these ships leave port and sail out to attack a convoy. There are various ways of doing this, and a lot of them are quite indirect. One of them is that because the RAF are constantly dropping mines around the Norwegian coast, it's typical for the Germans to do a mine sweep with minesweeper ships before they send an expensive and valuable ship to sea. You also need to provide air cover for ships at sea, so there'll be all these ancillary operations that either you catch them in the planning or you catch them taking place. But those kinds of things can give you a clue that a surface ship, a major unit, as it's called, is about to set out from the field. And this is why Bletchley Park has to read the intelligence and send it on to the Admiralty, because, you know, understanding those nuances is something that naval section is really good at. Sometimes you get information directly from the surface ships themselves, because with Tirpitz, for example, when it's in the field, they plug in a telephone line. So the Admiral on board can talk to Berlin direct. But the moment they sail, they have to unplug that telephone. They have to start using wireless. So if you pick up any messages at all from that ship, it kind of shows that it's not attached to the shore anymore. So it must be doing something.
Right.
So there's a variety of ways that they can identify what's going on. The skeptics say that actually it tells you more about what these ships have done than what they're about to do. And that's broadly true. But even knowing what they have done, you know, up until yesterday is still pretty useful. And if the message says that they were still in harbour yesterday, then they've only had a day to do anything. And we'll see this in the Scharnhorst story itself, that some of this information is quite indirect, but it's very, very useful nonetheless.
There must have been some major problems, though, some disadvantages of this delay in the period from interception to being able to send the intelligence to the Admiralty. You've explained the various advantages of the intelligence despite this delay, but surely were there not issues raised or issues caused by not being able to get this immediate intelligence?
There are a variety of problems, and it's not just the time delay. The time delay is one of the factors, and it varies. The German 48-hour key cycle means that you get periods when messages are read by Bletchley Park very quickly, and then periods where it takes much longer, and you get this sort of boom and bust in the product being produced. But the connection from here to the Admiralty is only the first leg of the journey, if you like, because the second problem you have is the Admiralty has to communicate that information to ships at sea. If they're trying to fight the war, the commander of the Home Fleet, for example, Admiral Fraser, he's got on board Duke of York and he sailed out with his aircraft carrier and his escorting destroyers and everything else. So intelligence information needs to be conveyed to him. They have a one-time pad system, a very secure cipher that they use to send Ultra to flag officers. So he can get the information. And similarly, the cruiser force commander, Bob Burnett, is a flag officer, so he can get the information. The convoy commander is too junior to be indoctrinated into Ultra, so they can't tell the convoy commander the actual intelligence. What they tend to do is they do a sort of less detailed, more general version that they send for the convoys themselves. That's fine, except that when Admiral Fraser gets that information, he can't ask any questions back because he's on radio silence. Because if he communicates by wireless at all, the Germans will use direction finding to find out where he is. There's a possibility they will also read his messages because the German code breaking up until 43 certainly is pretty good. So they are reading some of Allied traffic. The Admiralty, they know what the plan is from the outset, and then they can send messages out to sea, but they never get anything back from the ships at sea to tell them, to update them on what's happening. So they have to kind of guess what's going on. And this causes a problem because there's ripe space for misunderstanding, because if the Admiralty sends something to Fraser with the Home Fleet and they've based it on a background understanding of the situation that they have, but he doesn't have that background, he might misinterpret what they've told him, or that he might read the intelligence in a different way. So sometimes they will send him Ultra and they will follow it with some instructions. They'll say, here's the intelligence, here's what you should do about it. Other times they just send him the intelligence and let him make his own judgment. But the problem then they have is the Admiralty, they don't know what judgment he's made because he can't tell them. And sometimes they just send him instructions. They just say, just do this and take it for granted from us that we know what we're talking about. So all of those options exist and they all cause confusion.
Well, likewise, in the chain of command, he's having to have it on faith that the instructions are based on solid intelligence. The convoy commander, who hasn't been indoctrinated into Ultra, is also then having to take this on faith, and the various people on the other steps of the ladder aren't able to, as you say, feedback or question that.
Yes, and in the particular case of the Scharnhorst, you've got a convoy at sea with its own close escort of Royal Navy ships. You've got a cruiser force, Force 1 as it's known, and then you've got the Home Fleet covering force, the battleships, Force 2, and none of those are able to intercommunicate, and none of them know exactly where the others are. Fraser has a notion of where he thinks the convoy should be, according to, you know, the progress it should have made by that point, but he doesn't know exactly. But one of the useful things is, sometimes if one of those German reconnaissance aircraft has found the convoy and located its position, if that information is known to Bletchley Park, they tell the Admiralty, and the Admiralty can then send a message to Fraser and say, this is where the convoy was yesterday when the Germans found it. Mm-hmm. So they're actually using the German messages to tell them where their own ships are.
Which is incredibly beneficial, but yeah. As you say, it's all one way. I guess they're on radio silence because they will be immediately spotted if they're sending out signals.
The Germans are doing direction finding the same way as the British are. So the moment when those ships transmits, the Germans will triangulate on the signal and know where that ship is. And they will do their own traffic analysis to know what sort of a ship it is. Battleships' wirelesses make a different noise from submarine wirelesses, for example. So you can infer what ship it's likely to be that's transmitting, even if you can't break the code itself.
And it's some of this complexity that makes the war at sea, the intelligence picture, really fascinating.
That's what fascinates me about it. I mean, what's kind of surprising in some ways is the whole official history of the campaign. Stephen Roskill, who wrote the official history of the war at sea, wrote up all these battles, but he wasn't allowed to mention the Ultra at all. So he's describing all these ships moving around in the sea without mentioning kind of the crucial layer, if you like, which is how they know what the hell's going on.
It must appear that there's some sort of chaos going on here, or that there's just loads of guesswork.
People are actually much more intuitive than they
Informed, or just idiots, why are they doing that?
Yes. The Admiralty sent me a message that Tirpitz might have sailed from Norway, perhaps. One of the things that we talk about all the time, and it's worth stressing again, is that even the best Bletchley Park signals intelligence doesn't give you the answer. It gives you hints and tips. It needs to be interpreted. A lot of inference is involved, a lot of plain guesswork sometimes. And so these processes are never straightforward. And the information, there's a time delay. And also, you consider at Christmas 1943, in the winter in the Arctic, it's dark 23 hours a day anyway. So everyone's sailing around in the dark. Even if you could signal a message back to the Admiralty, working out your own position without modern GPS and things like that, if you've got a junior officer with a sextant on the top of the ship.
Yeah, so worth mentioning
that as
well.
In the middle of an Arctic storm, trying to take a star shot so he can do his navigation.
Gosh, yeah.
It's not easy. So most of the time, they only have a vague idea of where they are themselves, let alone where anybody else is.
Northwards to the Arctic Circle rides the convoy and escort bound for ports in northern Russia. Over 2,000 miles of dangerous waters, traversing the hard route that leads to Murmansk and Archangel. Laden with great cargoes of war material from Britain's factories, our ships head up to those northern latitudes carrying the weapons that Russia calls for. Upon the broad shoulders of the Royal Navy is placed the heavy and perilous task of getting the supplies to their destinations. Apart from the many hazards of war faced by the men who take the ships to the Soviet, they have to bear the full rigors of Arctic weather. And when the temperature drops far below zero, so intense is the cold that metal on the upper decks and the guns burns the flesh from their hands. Notwithstanding this, ceaseless watch is kept at all times of day and night. Out of the dim light of approaching night, an enemy bomber discovers the convoy, and in the gathering gloom comes in to attack. But the British Bulldog is very much awake. The help which Britain is giving to the Soviet is no light thing to be brushed aside. As her ally, we are fulfilling our obligations and will continue to do so until the Nazis are finally obliterated by the United Nations.
So bring us back to December 1943 and the action that was taking place.
Well, in the autumn of 1943, there has been a break in convoys to Russia. They learn in 1942 that actually during the summer, when it's perpetual daylight and relatively calm seas, I say relatively, it's still the Arctic, it's too dangerous to run convoys. So they typically suspend them. And it's only in September that they get going again and they have a sort of winter campaign, if you like. By that point, Admiral Fraser has been appointed as Commander Home Fleet. Admiral Tovey, who we've talked about in the past, has moved on to another job. Fraser has taken over. The reason they resume the convoys is Stalin is very anxious that convoys should start again. He's constantly complaining that because D-Day hasn't happened yet, He's carrying the burden of the war, he needs supplies, etc., etc. And so the political imperative from Churchill and from Roosevelt is to crack on, let's get convoys going again. So the Admiralty slightly reluctantly agreed to carry on. The initial suggestion is that they should run four convoys, basically one a month in kind of, you know, November, December, January, February kind of thing through the winter. But they've learnt in the winter of 1942 that if the convoys are too big, when it's dark, marshalling 40 or 50 ships out there in the dark, in the stormy waters, is hopeless, and the convoys tend to get broken apart very easily. So it's better to run twice as many convoys half the size, and this is what they go over to. And you end up with the convoys in this period, they've changed the coding as well. The PQ convoys that are famous from 1942 have become JW convoys. And they start at 50, so you get JW51, JW52, but then you also get JW51 is broken into A and B, And then JW52, A and B, and these are the sort of the half-size convoys, and they go every 2 weeks instead of every month. Of course, what that means is for the Royal Navy and for the Home Fleet, there's actually twice as much work, because instead of going out once a month to look after a convoy, they're basically going out twice a month, so that's a lot of work. At the same time, on the German side, after the Battle of the Barents Sea that we talked about earlier, the German Navy, even though they've only got two surface ships left, they've got Tirpitz and Scharnhorst, Dönitz is under massive pressure from Hitler to justify keeping them because they could have been scrapped at the beginning of the year. And he's going, well, if you've got them, show they're worth keeping. And so he's under huge political pressure to deliver on that and to sink some enemy ships. Dönitz actually issued a memorandum about this to his commanders, explaining the problem, the bind he was in with Hitler, really. And I can quote from him here from his memoir. The conditions required for successful operations by surface ships against traffic in the Arctic will occur very seldom. Whenever such an opportunity occurs, it must be seized with determination, but with due observance to tactical principles. It may also sometimes be considered necessary to attack heavily escorted convoys with all available forces. Orders to deliver such an attack will be given if the convoy in question is deemed to be of such high value that its destruction is of primary importance to the situation as a whole. And when he says the situation as a whole, he's mainly talking about the Eastern Front, because after the failed Battle of Kursk, the failed German Operation Citadel in the summer of 1943, the Germans are kind of on the back foot on the Eastern Front. Things are really starting to deteriorate for them there. So anything that interrupts the Russians' ability to fight is becoming a real priority for the Germans. In the absence of a second front in the West, it's their only preoccupation. So anything that can happen in the Arctic that will ostensibly help the troops on the Eastern Front is really important. So as they've done in previous occasions, the Germans come up with a plan. They sort of plan an event which they haven't set a timescale for. They say, right, next time we find a suitable convoy, we will enact this particular plan. So everybody's ready. They're just kind of waiting for the code words to swing into action. And actually, the first couple of convoys of the 1943 winter season sail without any interference from the Germans. They go to Murmansk and back again quite happily. But obviously the Germans are building up and waiting for one that they can find in sufficient time to sort of pounce on it. The convoy in question is JW-55B, which is the second half of convoy JW-55. It has 19 merchant ships in it, and it leaves Scotland, Lough Ewe on the west coast of Scotland, on the 20th of December 1943. Simultaneously, or within a day or two, the returning convoy of empty ships from Murmansk is coming back, convoy RA-55A, because the sequences are slightly out of sync. But the idea is these two convoys will sail from either end of the route, and actually they pass one another in the most constricted bit, the bit south of Bear Island.
Right.
So the German plan is actually, if you can catch them when they're sort of passing one another, you get a very target-rich environment.
It feels like you've rich got, pickings, doesn't
you've
it?
You've got then? Rich pickings because you've got ships going in all directions.
Yeah.
And so the Germans put together one of these wolf packs, as the Allies call it, a U-boat group, which they christen Eisenbart, which is German for Iron Beard. They give them these sort of dramatic code names. One's called like Highwayman, and another one's called Ice Teufel, which is like, you know, Ice Storm and things like this. They give them very kind of, you know, gung-ho names. And the German signals intelligence, the Bay-Dienst, the German Navy codebreakers, are good enough that they can predict pretty accurately when a convoy is sailing. There's enough traffic on British wireless networks for them to say, with some confidence, you know, a convoy has just sailed on this particular day. And if it leaves Lough Ewe in Scotland on a particular day, it's going to be 3 or 4 days before it gets to the bits of the Arctic Ocean that's important. So they've got a few days' notice. And that's exactly what happens. They send a 4-U-boat patrol line up to Bear Island. And the idea is they will get themselves in position and wait for the convoy to arrive. So much radio traffic was generated setting up the patrol line that Bletchley Park knows that it's been established on the 20th of December as the convoy sailing. So everybody pretty much knows what everybody else is doing. But the key factor for the Germans is firstly finding the convoy itself specifically, because, you know, knowing it's sailing is not the same thing as knowing where it is on its route.
Right.
And also they know that the home fleet will be out there and other Royal Navy assets will be out there. So they need to know where all the pieces are on the board. For that, they rely on the German reconnaissance aeroplanes. Unfortunately, the weather's so terrible that the Luftwaffe can't find anything. So everybody kind of waits. And it's only on the 22nd of December that the Luftwaffe actually managed to find the convoy and report where it is. And again, they redeploy the U-boats. They send more U-boats in response to that. And we know that that was picked up by Bletchley Park and that the Admiralty knew all about it. The deputy director of the Operational Intelligence Centre at the Admiralty, who are running these operations, is a chap called Captain Colpoys. And Captain Colpoys wrote an account of what went on, and he makes specific reference to the fact that the Allies knew what the Germans were up to on the 20th of December.
At 0049 hours on the 18th of December, 4 U-boats known as the Arctic Group, reinforced by 3 more from the Baltic, were ordered to take up positions along a line 135 miles east of Bear Island. On the 19th, these 7 boats were ordered to move further westward. Much signal traffic to and from these U-boats was read, giving positions of attacking areas, warnings of intended reconnaissance flights, reports of hydrophone contacts, etc. This information was passed out by Ultra.
Extract from Admiralty Use of Special Intelligence in Operations by Geoffrey Colpoys, Deputy Director of the Operational Intelligence Centre. Unpublished and held by the National Archives.
Of course, all this information is sent to Admiral Fraser. He's at sea with the Duke of York and the cruiser Jamaica and some destroyers. There's also the convoy, and then there's some more cruisers under Admiral Burnett. Fraser knows that on Christmas Eve, on the 24th, is the point when the two convoys are going to be passing one another. And that's, if the Germans are going to do anything, that's the point when it's all going to kick off. There's actually messages exchanged in the convoy itself where the convoy commodore says, on Christmas Eve, he sends a message saying, I expect we're going to be attacked tomorrow. Merry Christmas, kind of thing, you know.
So they know where. Everybody knows where. Everybody knows when. The British know that the Germans are lying in wait, most yes. likely, for them, just waiting for it all to start.
Yes. They know where the U-boats are. The only other threat is the Scharnhorst.
Mm.
And they know the Scharnhorst is in Altenfjord. It's in North Norway. It's there. And it could come out at any moment. Fraser also knows that from Altenfjord to where the convoy crossing point near Bear Island is only a couple hundred miles. So it's going to take Scharnhorst less than a day to get there. So he's not going to get much notice. If it's going to kick off, it's going to kick off very quickly. He is advised on the morning of the 24th that as far as Bletchley Park and the OIC are concerned, that the German surface fleet hasn't moved yet. So he's comfortable at that point that nothing has yet happened. but he's also concerned because he doesn't really know where his own assets are. As we said, his picture of the battle is quite poor. And so he does something really quite unusual. He breaks his own radio silence and he signals to the convoy and to the cruiser group and says, you break radio silence as well. I'll tell you where I am and you need to tell me where you are, because otherwise I can't fight the battle. That's all in ciphered, so it's not the case that the Germans will know exactly what's being said, but they will certainly be able to use direction finding and traffic analysis and gain a lot of intelligence information.
And it must have surprised the Germans as well, knowing that this was an impending action.
They'd been listening out for it, but they would have gone, you know, oh, thank you very much. And in a way, the fact that Fraser didn't get court-martialed for this is, or a naval board of inquiry, is that he won the battle. Right. I think had he not won the battle, people might have looked on this sort of breach of protocol in a rather less bright light. He gets everyone to tell them where he is, and he also instructs the convoy to change its course slightly, to move it a little bit further away from the Germans. And he slows it down a bit so that it's not in the critical area where he thinks the U-boats are until it's dark, because there's like an hour and a half or something of daylight. Mm-hmm. And he goes, don't go into the danger area while it's still light, because U-boats can see you. Slow down and wait till it's dark before you go. So he sort of tweaks things a little bit.
And he has these two convoys from different directions as well.
Yes, he's got two convoys coming in different directions. He's got a lot of pieces in play. The Germans have this sort of similar situation. Admiral Bay, who is the German commander, who is based on Tirpitz, but Tirpitz is being repaired at this point. So he has his headquarters on there and he's going to transfer onto the Scharnhorst once it's sailed, once the battle starts. They're in a sort of now or never situation as well, because they know that the pressure is absolutely on them from Berlin to prove their worth. And the time to do that is this window of the 25th, 26th, when the two convoys are passing each other. If they don't do it then, they've got to wait another 2 weeks, another month. They've got to wait for another suitable convoy to come along. This is a kind of a one-off opportunity for them too. So they're really under pressure to react as well. They decide on sort of lunchtime Christmas Day, the Germans decide, no, let's go for it. Let's send Scharnhorst out. And as I've said, they've got the whole plan in hand and they've given it the code name Ostfront, which is a fairly unimaginative code name because, you know, Eastern Front, it's clear what the operation's all about. But because it's pre-planned, all they need to do is Admiral Peters, who's Commander Northern Waters, sends a signal, is simply Ostfront, 1700, 25th of the 12th. So begin that operation at 5 o'clock on Christmas Day. And that's exactly what the fleet does. And Dönitz backs this up by sending the Admiral a sort of pep talk message as well to emphasize even further how important it is, both strategically and politically, for the German Navy. On this occasion, what Dönitz says is, important enemy convoy carrying food and war material to the Russians further imperils our heroic army on the Eastern Front. We must help. Attack convoy with Scharnhorst and destroyers. Exploit tactical situation with skill and daring. Do not end engagement with a partial success. Go all out and see the job right through. Best chance of success lies in superior firing power of Scharnhorst. Therefore, try to bring her into action. Deploy destroyers as appropriate. But then he takes it all back. He says, break off according to your own judgment. Break off in any circumstances if faced by heavy units.
That's confusing.
This is the problem. It's like, win the battle, but don't take any chances.
Throw everything at them, but keep it back if you need to.
Yes, which is kind of the strategic problem that the Germans have throughout. Oh, he finishes. Inform crews accordingly. I have every confidence in you. Heil und Sieg, Dönitz, Großadmiral.
Inform crews accordingly of these contradictory statements that I've just given you.
It's kind of a theme throughout the campaign that it's go all out, but don't risk the ships, but make sure you destroy the enemy ships. And it makes life really difficult for the German commanders at sea because they're constantly in this struggle. I mean, the Royal Navy has a rather more sort of laissez-faire attitude. In the Royal Navy, if the enemy turns up, even if you've got a ship that is doomed, you know, in a destroyer and two battleships come along, you're still expected to attack them.
Mm-hmm.
You're expected to go all out regardless. It can be slightly suicidal on occasions, but it's definitely the ethic of the Royal Navy.
Straight at them.
Straight at them. Let them have it.
During the most critical period, the Pygmy aircraft carrier was one of the Royal Navy's most powerful secret weapons. These former merchantmen, equipped with flight decks, sailing in convoy, their planes keeping constant watch, the little carriers were a constant threat to the lurking U-boat. Navy flyers take plenty of chances each time they make a landing on decks only 380 feet long. The men of the carriers have played a great and heroic part.
The Scharnhorst sailed at 1700 on Christmas Day. What happened next?
Well, Bletchley Park figured that out pretty rapidly because of the sort of ancillary activity, because of air activity and minesweeping and everything else. And they're able to signal to both Fraser and Burnett out in the Arctic Ocean. Scharnhorst probably sailed 1800 A, 25th of December, and that's Greenwich Mean Time, so it's 1700 is the German time. And that message goes out at 2 in the morning on Boxing Day, so it's 8 hours, 9 hours after the Scharnhorst has sailed. So it's not immediate, but it's pretty good. And so at that point, Fraser knows that the game is on, you know, the German ships are at sea. And so he takes the decision at 4 a.m. to break radio silence again, to find out where everybody is and to make sure that he's got a full grip on the situation. And basically, the two convoys have crossed. The returning convoy is way to the west now and is out of the picture, really. It's not going to get attacked. But the outgoing convoy, JW55B, is just to the south of Bear Island and is right in the middle of the danger zone, effectively. Admiral Burnett's cruisers are making their way towards the convoy, but they're not with it at that point, out to the east. And Admiral Fraser himself is down to the southwest, sort of closer to Iceland, but heading in the direction of the action. But he knows that Scharnhorst, meanwhile, is heading north from the North Cape straight towards the convoy, essentially.
And likely to intercept before he's anywhere
near. Once he's worked all this out, he sends Burnett, the cruiser commander, instructions to get to the convoy as soon as he can and to try and find Scharnhorst, essentially. One of the interesting things at this point is that Bletchley Park are still reading the traffic, but there's an acknowledgement in the Operational Intelligence Centre and the Admiralty that the delays and all the issues we've discussed means that their influence on the battle at this stage is pretty minimal. They can follow what's going on, but they can't follow what's going on in a time loop that will allow them to influence it. They've essentially become spectators. This is what we're saying about the beginning, about Bletchley Park contributes to the battle, but is also kind of a spectator on the battle, because you get to a point on Boxing Day when the people here in this building in Naval Section are still reading the traffic. There's nothing they can do about it. They just have to watch events unfold on their teleprinters in Naval Section. Patrick Beasley, who worked in OIC, summarised that. He said, "During the course of Boxing Day, another dozen German signals were decrypted, but fascinating though some of them were, none was received in time to be of operational value. OIC had already played its part. It was now up to those at sea." And it's this sense that they're just now spectators on events. This is when luck plays its part for the Allies, because the cruiser force are sailing back towards where the convoy is. And at that moment, Scharnhorst sailed into the space between the cruisers and the convoy. So the cruisers are to the east, the convoy is to the west, and Scharnhorst is sailing up the gap in between. And HMS Belfast picked up radar contact. The bearing of the radar contact is exactly the bearing that they think the convoy's on. So initially they go, is that the convoy? They go, no, it's a lone ship and it's a very big ship, so it's clearly not a convoy, it must be Scharnhorst. On the basis of HMS Belfast's radar detection of Scharnhorst, Burnett's cruiser force spread out into line and basically charged towards Scharnhorst.
This is HMS Belfast, which is still in existence. Visitors can visit it in London. It's on the Thames, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it's that HMS Belfast.
Now a visitor attraction.
Yes.
Right, so, very, very highly recommended.
So you can go and stand on the bridge where Burnett would have been watching the battle.
Wow.
A gun battle starts between them, and Scharnhorst has much bigger guns, longer range guns. So even though there's three British ships, the balance of power is probably with the Germans. But as we know, Admiral Bay is really conscious of this, you know, don't risk your ship. So he makes a run for it. He turns away from the convoy and sails initially sort of southwest. This presents a problem for Admiral Burnett because he knows his cruisers are slower than Scharnhorst. So if he chases the German ship, it's highly likely that he'll lose it because it's just too quick. But he decides that what the Germans are probably going to do is they're going to sail away and then kind of double round and try and come back towards the convoy from a different direction. So he figures out if he just loiters around near where the convoy is, he doesn't need to do anything because Scharnhorst will come back.
They'll return and they will resume return attack,
and then he can resume the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like when Fraser breaks radio silence, this is a decision that if things had gone wrong, the Admiralty would have been very grumpy about.
So risky.
Because the Royal Navy doctrine, as we were saying, is you don't voluntarily break off contact with the enemy ship, let it sail away. You chased after it to the best of your ability. Carry on fighting it. He is vindicated when a few hours later, sure enough, slightly further to the north, the Scharnhorst reappears. And on this occasion, he's between it and the convoy. So they have another sort of brief engagement. And then again, Scharnhorst takes the course of least resistance and breaks off again. And at that point, Admiral Bay decides that he can't actually get to the convoy and his advantage of surprise has been lost and that his best policy is probably to go back to Norway. And at that point, he turns from the hunter to the hunted in that sense, because the Allies now know where he is. Burnett is able to send a wireless message to Fraser because he's not giving anything away because he's there with the Scharnhorst.
He can say
what he likes. So he says, you know, I've got the enemy ship. I'm pursuing it. You know, this is where we are, et cetera, et cetera. And so Scharnhorst sets off southwards.
At this point, it feels like the battle is between the big dogs. Are there U-boats still in the area?
There are still U-boats in the area. The Germans still have their five destroyers. But the problem that Admiral Bay has is Scharnhorst being a big, fast ship in Arctic waters in a bad sea state, the destroyers just can't keep up. They're too slow. They're not good, what are termed good sea boats. They really struggle in bad weather. So if he stays with his destroyers, it really reduces his freedom of action. So he sets them a separate task of going to look for the convoy. Again, luck plays a factor because there's two occasions when the German destroyers get very close to the convoy. They get within 8 miles of it, but they just miss it. And again, had they found it and got amongst it, it would have been a totally different story. But by bad luck or good luck, depending which side you're on, they just miss it. And eventually they're just told, go back to Norway. You're no longer part of the battle. So they sort of sail out of the picture. And one of the criticisms of Bay after the battle is he didn't command his destroyers well enough. But he has this problem that they're more of a burden than an asset in bad weather. You end up with a situation where Scharnhorst is going hell for leather, basically due south back to Norway, trying to get away. Burnett and the cruisers are chasing after it. They try not to fight it. They're just trying to keep up so they've got enough. It's within radar range. They can still tell where it is, but they're not actually shooting at it. And they follow it. And all the while, they are sending messages to Admiral Fraser with his battleship, Duke of York, which allows him to make a course to intersect with Scharnhorst. And that's indeed what happens in the late afternoon of Boxing Day.
It is fitting that we open this composite pictorial account of the great naval action with the huge bulk of the British Home Fleet flagship Duke of York framed in the Arctic darkness in which he brought the Scharnhorst to her doom. The convoy route to Russia around the North Cape witnessed the end of Germany's one serviceable battleship. Out of Alten Fjord came the Scharnhorst on Christmas Day, steering to intercept our merchant ships, setting sail on a mission from which she never returned. Once too often was she to venture out into the North Sea. Glance once again at the North Cape and the waters wherein the Scharnhorst lies fathoms deep. Thrill at the sight of the barrow-built cruiser Jamaica, which sent her torpedoes into the crippled enemy, and with her sister ships under Admiral Burnett, drove the Scharnhorst into a destroyer ambush. The whole of the action was fought in the dark. Brilliant work by the destroyer screen slowed up the Scharnhorst, which enabled the great guns of the Duke of York to score repeated hits.
At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Fraser gets to a point where Duke of York's radar picks up the Scharnhorst. And at that point, if you imagine a sort of clock face with Scharnhorst in the middle, Burnett's cruisers are coming down from 12 o'clock and Fraser is coming in from sort of 7 o'clock. Norway is at 6 o'clock. So they've got Scharnhorst in the jaws of a vice at that point. But Admiral Bay and Scharnhorst still have this advantage that they have a very fast ship. And the decision they take is to turn sort of 90 degrees and head east, further towards Murmansk, which won't get them directly to Norway, but they're still fast enough to outrun the British fleets. They have a brief gun battle. Both Scharnhorst and Duke of York engage one another, and they've both got massive guns on them, so it's pretty serious stuff. And one of the gun turrets on Scharnhorst is damaged. But Bay starts to get away. He's steaming away, and he's doing something like 28 knots. Burnett's fleet can only manage sort of 22, 24 knots. So Fraser, he does have destroyers available, which are, again, quite fast, but they have the same seagoing problems as German ones. But also, he doesn't want to send his destroyers up to where Scharnhorst is because it'll confuse the picture, because when you're trying to shoot at a ship, you don't want lots of other ships sort of milling about in there, confusing your radar. Fraser actually signalled Admiral Burnett in the cruisers, and he said, I see little hope of catching Scharnhorst. And he thinks the moment's gone. But again, all of these battles are about luck. One 14-inch shell from Duke of York hits the stern end of Scharnhorst and penetrates to the engine room, essentially. And suddenly Scharnhorst is gone from, you know, nearly 30 knots to only about 20 knots, and indeed even slower than that. So she slows down massively. And that lucky hit means that it's all over for them. Fraser can then catch up with Duke of York and his destroyers. Burnett and the cruisers can come down and they fire star shell, they illuminate Scharnhorst, and just it's a pile on. All the ships fire at it, and the destroyers are released to go in and fire torpedoes from close range, and something like 50 torpedoes are fired at Scharnhorst, of which over a dozen hit.
Gosh.
So at that point, Scharnhorst got no chance. and the German ship sinks. 7:48 is the recorded time. And that's probably from torpedo strikes. The wreck, when it was identified recently by an undersea expedition, the bows had blown off the ship completely. Oh. This is probably from a torpedo strike.
Right.
But it's dark anyway. There's a lot of ships around. There's an enormous pall of smoke. And Fraser doesn't actually know whether Scharnhorst has sunk or not. He gets a message from his own radar people saying, we've lost contact with the enemy ship. And he starts shouting at them, going, well, get contact back.
Not that the ship's not there anymore.
And then they go, wait a minute, it's because the ship's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And Belfast fires Starshell. They illuminate the scene, and it's clear that there's oil and debris and there's a few bodies in the water, but the Scharnhorst has gone, and they've won. Of course, Scharnhorst sinking like this results in enormous loss of life. Her total complement is just under 2,000 men. 1,930 of them go down with the ship. Only 30 sailors are recovered. The reason for that mainly is it's dark, it's the middle of the night, but also the Allied ships, Fraser's force, know that the U-boats are out there and they can't really linger picking up survivors because they risk being sunk themselves. So they pick up the few they can, they see immediately, and they get something like 36 men out of the sea, all of whom are junior ranks, none of whom is older than 22 years old. And they have to sail away.
I hate this. I'm married to a Royal Naval officer, and I know there was a war on, but stories like this are just always horrendous.
And the veteran testimony you read, and Fraser himself said that at that moment, he really struggled to take any pleasure in it. It was there, but for the grace of God. And that was shared by a lot of the people on all of the Allied ships. His exchange with the Admiralty is kind of typical, a mixture of naval reserve and a lack of desire for any sort of celebration. He simply signals two words. He signals, Scharnhorst sunk. That's it. And the Admiralty reply, you're 26-2035, which is 2035 on the 26th of December. You're 26-2035. Grand. Well done. Full stop. That's it. The sinking of the Scharnhorst results in, as I've said, an enormous loss of life. It's a curious statistic that in that one sinking, the German Navy loses more men than the Royal Navy lost in the whole Arctic campaign. The Royal Navy takes about 1,800 casualties of Royal Naval personnel in the whole of the Arctic convoy operations. The Germans lose 1,900 just in the sinking of Scharnhorst. It's a very grim day for all concerned. However, it has been a success both strategically and tactically by the ships at sea, but also it's an intelligence coup. The information provided from Bletchley to the Admiralty and what they're able to tell Fraser and Burnett and everybody has led to this outcome. And we talked about Captain Colpoys earlier, who was in the Operational Intelligence Centre. He summed up exactly this in his report on the events.
A steady flow of special intelligence, up to the time that our forces made contact with the enemy, enabled the CNC to keep CNC Home Fleet and Flag Officer of the 10th Cruiser Squadron, Vice Admiral Bernard, regularly informed of German surface, aircraft and U-boat moves. The interval between the time of origin of a German message and that of the ultrasignal based thereon varied from 5 to 12 hours. The value of special intelligence in this particular operation can be judged by the fact that it provided the only source of information on Scharnhorst's departure from Altafjord. It also revealed the enemy's ignorance of the odds with which he was called upon to contend.
Extract from Admiralty Use of Special Intelligence in Operations by Geoffrey Colpoys, Deputy Director of the Operational Intelligence Centre. Unpublished and held by the National Archives.
You've explained how Bletchley Park staff were effectively spectators on this. How soon after the Scharnhorst was sunk did they find out?
Well, we know more or less exactly because one of the many ZTPG messages comes from the night of Boxing Day 1943. The teleprint was actually sent at 11:31 p.m. So that's 4 hours after the ship has sunk. And I can read you it. ZTPG 195,207, which is from FO Cruisers, Flag Officer Cruisers, who is Admiral Bay, and CO of Scharnhorst, that's the captain of the Scharnhorst. FO Cruisers and CO of Scharnhorst report at 18:15 to the Führer. We shall fight to the last shell. And that was it. That was the last message broadcast from Scharnhorst, which was intercepted and came through here in Naval Section only a few hours after the event. And it carries the timestamp 23:31, 11:30, on the 26th of the 12th, 43. And then there are the initials CEL and AM. And that's Charles Leach, who was head of B-Watch, watch officer at the time, and WAF Corporal Marshall, who did the actual typing. Much as there was satisfaction, on the Allied side, there was, you know, a furious reaction on the German side. And Admiral Bay went down with the Scharnhorst. So he becomes the scapegoat on the German side for all of their failures. But he is, as we've already described, between a rock and a hard place. He's told, you know, go all out, but don't risk your ship. And in the end, he gambles and loses. But the fact that he doesn't engage with the cruisers on the two occasions when he's up near the convoy, and he could have potentially fought them a lot harder than he did, people take that as a reflection of the fact that the German Navy by this point has, to put it colloquially, kind of lost its bottle a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Admiral Cunningham, who of course many people will know as the commander in the Mediterranean, when Fraser takes over Home Fleet, Cunningham takes over as First Sea Lord. So he's in sort of ultimate supervisory command of all this. He's replaced Dudley Pound of PQ-17 fame, who died of a brain tumour in late 1943. And Admiral Cunningham, in his memoirs, summed up the German performance and made exactly this point.
As usual, Hitler's Navy had shown little of the fighting spirit of the Imperial German Navy of 1914-18. It was rather like the Admiral Graf Speer of Rügen. When the Scharnhorst made contact with our cruisers the second time, she turned and fled for home. She was a ship of great tonnage and high speed, armed with 11-inch guns. Her three opponents were smaller, weaker, and slower. In the weather and visibility then prevailing, by all the tenets of naval warfare, she should have been able to brush the Belfast, Sheffield, and Norfolk aside, attack the convoy, and have broken away in safety after destroying it. But the will was not there. No wonder Hitler was displeased.
Extract from A Sailor's Odyssey by Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham, published in 1951.
Did the staff at Bletchley Park know the role that they'd played in the battle?
This is one of the interesting things. We've talked about how Sheila Holden was typing these teleprints, so she was right there following the action, if you like, albeit at a few hours' delay. But her position is really unusual. For the rest of the Bletchley Park staff, most of them were involved in processes that they didn't know what was going on at all. They barely understood the processes they were doing. So, for example, in the Hollerith section, punch card machines were used very intensively in breaking Naval Enigma. But the women who were operating them wouldn't have seen any of the results of that. They would have never seen a decrypted Enigma message, for example. They would have just punched their cards and done their daily job.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing they would have known about it was when they saw it in the papers or, you know, on the BBC. And Peggy Munn, who worked in Block C on Hollerith, describes exactly this, that the first she knew about it was when she went to the cinema.
We heard in the night, our boss came out and saying, oh, we've got some good news. The British fleet have sunk the Scharnhorst. Well, we'd all heard on the pathy news at the cinema and everywhere about the Scharnhorst was Hitler's best, biggest battleship. And to think that, you know, we had sunk it, not we, but that the British Navy had sunk it, was another cause for celebration, hugging each other and dancing up and down. And then we were told that he was going to come to Bletchley Park because he wanted to thank everybody at Bletchley Park for helping him sink the Scharnhorst. Well, you can't believe that, that we, doing this card system and what we were doing, could help a man in the sea to sink a battleship, could you? And so it was a bit amazing, really. And it really helped us link what we were doing with the outside world and the war effort.
Later on, Peggy gets an even more personal account of the events because she meets Admiral Fraser himself. He came to visit Bletchley Park because he was aware of the role that intelligence had played in informing him what was going on in the battle. And so he made a visit to GCNCS to meet the people who'd helped break German Naval Enigma, of whom Peggy was one.
6 weeks later, he was going to come and thank people at Bletchley Park. Well, this was him arriving 6 weeks later, and he came to Block C, and he'd been at the end, and he stopped, but I hadn't seen him. I was too busy with my three machines. So when he got a bit nearer, he told me not to run. And so I switched the noises machine off and just stood there horrified, you know. And he came along and he put his arms around my shoulder and gave me a hug and said, we've come to thank you all you girls and everybody, for helping us to sink the Scharnhorst. It was a wonderful thing for us, and we couldn't have done it without you. Mm. And he waved to all the girls. Some of them looked up and thought, well, who's he? And took way back. But he gave me another big hug, and then he asked me what I was doing. Well, as I didn't know what I was doing, it was a bit difficult. And so I said, well, it's rather complicated, and it might take a bit of a time you know, a bit long time to tell him what it was all about. And he nodded wisely, like, you know, said, yes, I understand. And he was a lovely man and gave me another hug around my shoulders and went on. And the two sailors sort of patted my shoulder a little bit when they went past. So that was my best memory of Bletchley Park, being cuddled by the Admiral of the Fleet that sunk the Scharnhorst.
Admiral Fraser also went on to give a lecture to staff in the mansion here at Bletchley Park to tell everybody about, you know, the battle itself. Peggy was very keen to go to that, but because of the demand, they had a ballot for tickets and she didn't get a ticket, but her colleague Joan Jocelyn did.
There was another episode where we had been working till late in the evening and suddenly the news came through that because of our efforts, they had located the Scharnhorst in the Norwegian field. And we thought no more about it. We were through to bits. I think we'd been involved in it. Later, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser came to Bletchley Park and asked for the people that had been involved in deciphering the message be allowed to come to the, into the mansion and be told the full story. And so we trotted over, didn't we, Ken? And that was lovely. And he told us the whole story, which was sad, really, because it was a very hard-fought battle. The next morning in my billet where I was staying, the news came over the radio how wonderful that we captured the Scharnhorst and sunk it with the loss of so few men, which was entirely different to what Sir Bruce Fraser had told us. That was marvellous. That was really interesting. So there were a few episodes like that which, you know, made you feel that you were really doing some good, you know.
What wonderful women. We're so lucky to have sources like this. David, you've obviously written a book on this and the Arctic convoys very recently, and you've used sources like this in that.
Yes, I mean, I was very lucky in the book that not only is all the message traffic available in the National Archives, and there are other Bletchley Park documents that tell the official story, if you like, but our own oral history collection is very rich in contributions from people who were here. And so you get the other side of the code-breaking story. I mean, Sheila sitting there in this very building overnight at Christmas, you know, experiencing that really brings the story to life for me. And not only for the Scharnhorst episode, but the whole book, I had the opportunity to draw on those resources and people the story with characters and their own individual experiences, which was a really satisfying thing.
Mm. And speaking of personal stories, podcast producer Mark, you also have a special interest from a personal angle on this story too, don't you?
I do, yes. My stepdad, Mick Chalkley, served on HMS Victorious, which was a fleet aircraft carrier. Not actually in the Scharnhorst battle. They were more at the earlier part of the Arctic convoy story. He was a fleet air arm air mechanic, so he was fixing the planes, the Swordfish and the Fulmers that were out attacking the German ships.
So do you have anything that he has left behind from that, his service record? Or
it's really weird. So I've got his service record. I've got some of his photos he took at the time. So I've got photos of, like, the deck of Victorious, obviously on an Arctic convoy because the deck is covered in snow and the crew are having a snowball fight, by the looks of it, and other parts of the ship literally where they're trying to hack these huge stalactites of ice off the ship.
Mm.
But very much like a lot of veterans I've met, he never wanted to talk about what he did in the battle side of things. Mick was a jazz clarinet and saxophone player for his entire life. He literally played until a week before he died at 93, and he played every day. He would talk for hours about the different bands that he set up while he was serving during the war, but he only ever once spoke about anything that happened on a convoy, and that was during Operation Pedestal, because that's why they're not involved in this part of the Arctic battle, because they go off to the Mediterranean to do convoy duty down there. But he didn't want to talk about that at all. And that's what's been really interesting about David's book, because I get to hear what he went through.
Yeah, the conditions these men were in, the dark, the freezing cold, and also the fear, the impending battles, the inevitable, I guess, when these convoys are coming under attack.
And it's like when David's saying about the age of the crew that were picked up out the sea. Mick's first action on Victorious is the day after his 21st birthday, in May 1941, and he's readying Swordfish to go off and attack the Bismarck. He's 21 years old.
Mm.
You know, he was probably getting on a bit You know, he was probably quite old for a junior ranked seaman. You know, he went on to become a petty officer, but probably at this time he was, you know, air mechanic second class or something. You know, he was one off junior rank at that point. So, yeah, I've learned so much from David's book about what he would have been through, not just what Victorious itself did, but they all would have had a shared memory of that, a shared experience of that. So it's been quite an eye-opener, I must admit, because, like I say, Mick wouldn't talk about it at all. It's been one of the things that drew me to doing this, because I knew that the people who worked here, and I've met plenty of them, and I've been able to thank them personally, because I know they've had some part in keeping him alive, which meant I got to meet him years later. You know, I got to have a stepdad. So, you know, being able to thank some of these veterans for what they did, and, you know, the look on their face, and they're like, oh, really? Yeah, and thanks for keeping me stepdad alive.
Yeah.
You know, it's been lovely. And it's something that's been, it does make it really personal.
On the other side of that, obviously, the enormous contribution that people at Bletchley Park played, but the resilience, the courage of these men at the pointy end as well, you must be so proud.
Oh, yeah. There is a photo taken, not during the Arctic convoys, but during the attack on the Bismarck. And it's the end of the day when all of the deck crew are all lined up on the flight deck of HMS Victorious. And you have never seen such a bunch of knackered-looking men in your life. And they're all about, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21. They're not very old. And you'd think, I wouldn't have been able to do that at 21. I'm on a, you know, probably 800-foot ship in the middle of the Atlantic fighting the biggest battleship in the world. But they just look like they've had a hard day at work. It's unbelievable. But, yeah, I'm very proud of him. And that's why I'm really proud to do this, because it's my little way of saying thank you to those veterans for what they did.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.